Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 25th, 2005. Today's session is entitled John 14, No One Comes to the Father Except Through Me. Presented by Pam Fikencher, session number FIP 2005-04. Let's listen in.
Will you pray with me? God, we ask that as you burn brightly in your word, we might turn aside and behold the wonder, that you would give us ears to hear your voice and eyes to see your work in the world. In Christ's name.
I just finished. Do you like this closed?
Yeah, go ahead. Thanks.
Hey.
And I guess I should say Berta Antonio. That's our signal to start. I recognize many of your faces. Who's first time here today? Okay. All right, good. Most of this week, we've been looking at the book of Acts and looking at issues of inclusion and exclusion and how did the early church spread the gospel, or more importantly, how did God work in the early church as the news began to spread? And we've been looking mainly at Luke Acts, but today we're taking a little detour. So this is our one and only day with the Gospel of John. I said earlier that we could, you know, the subtitle maybe for this week could be passages that I used to hate that are growing on me. And that is no less true with the Gospel of John today. The Gospel of John is not my favorite gospel for a number of reasons, and I think it's very beloved for some folks and also very problematic for some folks, and at least one of the person here said it was his least favorite gospel, so it'd be kind of interesting to do a little poll here on how people feel about the Gospel of John. If you're a Lutheran, if you're in the electionary-based church, chances are you hear a lot of John. John gets plenty of airtime in our worship services. The Lutheran tradition has tended to use John a lot, partly because it has a very what they call a very high Christology. In other words, it's one of those books that's pulled out again and again when we talk about who Jesus is as Son of God. But it's very, very different from the other three Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And since we've been looking at Acts, we've been dealing mostly with Luke and theology, Luke's understanding of who Jesus is. I wanted to do this detour today because John's perspective is so different, and because John's community, because the gospel, reflects a piece of early church history that is very, very much concerned with who is in and who is out. And how do we deal with inclusion and exclusion? And John reflects that, not explicitly, but it's certainly between the lines a lot in the Gospel of John. So I thought it might be helpful for us to take a look at that and just respond to it. So my opener question was, yesterday we talked a little bit about, we had some folks from, you know, many folks here from Washington, Oregon, West Coast, and then, you know, Holden's probably second biggest contingent is Minnesotans like myself. Very different context in which to be the church in terms of what the vast majority of people's experiences of religious life, whether they're considering themselves churchgoers or not. And for full disclosure, how many pastors are there in this room? Probably quite a few. Okay. Yeah. So yeah. And we, of course, have our own perspective, right, on these texts, because we bring with us not just our own faith perspective, but the question of, you know, anytime you open up the scriptures, okay, how is this going to preach? And that certainly has been my struggle sometimes with the Gospel of John. But as we think about where we're from and who's in, who's out, what kind of language we use when we talk about what the gospel means and who Jesus is, Let's think for a minute about what... Are there places where we are very conscious of being of using what I would call public language or outsider language, where we're talking about where we as the church, or perhaps even just as an individual in conversation, where are the places where you're very conscious that anything you say is going to be heard not just by other Christians, but by people who don't know what they think about Jesus, or maybe haven't even really given Jesus a second thought?
Monday morning cabinet meetings with the executive director. Very public. Don't say anything that you don't want to come back and haunt you.
So in your workplace? Okay.
Yes.
Now, are you in the business world then, or what's your...
It's a public agency.
Okay. So, yeah. Anybody else? Outsider? When are you conscious of, you know...
All the time.
Yeah. All the time. Are you from?
I'm from Alaska. We're on a par with Alaska. Oregon and Washington. So there's numbers of people who have no knowledge of the church.
Okay.
And I have some even within my congregation who have very little exposure to, you know, didn't go to church as a child. And so I never know what anybody really already thinks until I talk with them.
We're active in Lutheran Marriage Encounter, and many people come on a Marriage Encounter weekend, either unchurched or loosely church, uh-huh. and so we need to be very clear on the weekend.
And we've experienced it in other countries, too.
Other cultures.
Cultures,
yeah. Experienced...
Weekends, serving.
Marriage Encounters?
Marriage Encounter. Okay. Brazil, Australia.
Norway.
All the Nordic countries.
Yeah.
I live in a small town in Idaho that is a university town, and a lot of the people who have come there are formerly church people who are no longer church people because the church, they believe, has dealt irresponsibly with its own mandate to... live and proclaim the gospel. Mm-hmm.
I find I need to be very careful around folks who are active in animal rights and environmental, which to me is pretty ironic. But I think that you know they've got a sense of Christianity as a dominating religion.
My husband's an environmental policy analyst and works largely with, you know, people who are pretty, he works in the policy world, so it's public sector, but also with a lot of environmental folks, and he has that same, you know, people find out that he's married to a minister, they're like, oh, really? <You know? laughs> And then the funny thing is that sometimes, you know, there'll be this sort of initial negative reaction, they'll say, you know, she's a Lutheran or whatever, and they're like, oh, okay. And it almost makes me wonder, okay, what does that mean? She's safe because she's Lutheran, so we don't need to worry about her too much. But it's sometimes in that environmental world, there's sort of this assumption that the Christians are, that's dangerous territory, yeah.
I was talking with a group of young adults, early 20s kind of thing, and one of the fellows said that he went to church because his girlfriend went to church. And so I said, well, what's that like for you? He said, well, I found nothing I could connect with until we got to coffee and I could talk with some of those older folks.
I have a little trouble with the terms insider, outsider, and unchurched, as if there's something defective or deficient about those folks. It just kind of bothers me.
Yeah. Maybe better, and as we get into John here, I think sometimes, I mean, the churched, unchurched language can be problematic too.
What's better language?
Well, I wonder whether it's maybe something about sort of public versus communal, or John, I would say John is in some ways a really intimate gospel. It uses a lot of intimate language. Assuming that most of its audience is going to share a certain understanding of who Jesus is, and it's about deepening that kind of community relationship rather than being a really public proclamation of, you know, for those who might not be part of that circle. One place, I mean, just really nitty-gritty kind of thing that comes up in our congregation these days is we have a website. And as a congregation, it's, okay, what kind of language are we using in there? Are we talking, is the website for the congregation so we can use our shorthand and kind of assume that people know what we're about if they're coming to look at the website? Or is it a very public place, in which case we need to, and it is, I mean, it's accessible to anybody, right? So do we think about it in a much more public way and therefore have to screen a little more carefully what goes on there, whose names and phone numbers get published, what links we put on there, you know, do we endorse this or not?
Or just the kind of language that you use in terms of talking to the public.
Right. Do we assume that folks share our common faith when they, if they're coming to that place or not? Is it, you know, Paul on the Areopagus, or is it something else when we use the web? Yeah.
I think we have to be a little careful to not assume that everyone within the church walls has the same perspective.
Right, and even within the congregation.
What we find in our church is that there are all levels, including just the very casual attender. Mm-hmm. And so the language that we have tended to gravitate towards is the general public welcoming kind of language. Mm-hmm. So rather than insiders and outsiders, we all began as outsiders. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of a gradation. And so I think we have to speak intimately and deeply, but we also have to be invitational. Mm-hmm. Without confronting. Mm-hmm. And so I think that this division that we talk about really is a very, very fuzzy line.
Yeah.
I think the emerging, I always say that in quotes, emerging churches, they emerge from somewhere else, obviously, from our own ranks, uh-huh. is they won't, what they know catches people who aren't part of our club or whatever you want to call it, is precisely this welcoming.
Yeah.
But then they get you, you want to know what they actually believe, what they actually will demand of you later. You have to go then to what they would call discipleship or under there. And it's then you start to actually, but by then they already have the hook in you. Yeah. And they work very hard, by the way, to love you and welcome you and be inclusive. Uh-huh. Until you really realize later, I mean, I could, one of the largest churches in Tacoma right now is called New Song. It's just Old Song with a mosh pit. And they actually separate the men and women, of course, later on in their discipleship. They teach women one thing and they teach the men the other, biblically based, though, by the way. Mm-hmm. There's a very strong Bible. So I just think they the method is working for them. For us, we're trying to figure out how to, you know, be inclusive.
Well, and the question sometimes is,
and forget about discipleship.
Yeah.
Well,
you use the term emergent church, and I'm just, I mean, I would probably question
that.
I know folks within the emerging church circles who are very suspicious of that particular approach. They would call that a bait and switch, you know.
Right.
Everybody's welcome, come on in. But if you really want to be the disciple, then you need to come on Wednesday nights, and that's when they use more insider language. What I would say, this or there's a public welcome, which is very, critics might call watered down. And then there's the insider language, which is more high demand, more high threshold discipleship sort of stuff. And then emergent church would, in my opinion, and this is coming out of my experience in Spirit Garage and stuff, would say maybe the issue isn't, you know, we got to have two levels here, the public welcome and then the discipleship, but how do we invite people into an experience in a way that is welcoming, regardless of sort of where they're at?
Welcoming and honest.
And honest, exactly.
And honest.
And genuine.
Who is Jesus?
Yeah. Okay, well, that's just to sort of get some of those issues on the table, because these are very contemporary sorts of things for us. Although, obviously, the early church's context was very different social, politically, we have the same struggles with sometimes trying to figure out how do we speak in a way that is comprehensible and welcoming and doesn't immediately kind of turn folks away, and at the same time is very genuine and allows us to express the full depth of our faith and not just sort of the surface level. And that's, I think sometimes that's the question. Do we go this way or do we go this way, and can we do both at the same time, or do we need to do one first and then the other? So we're just going to read one short passage of John, and we're going to read it several times over the course of the morning. We've been, instead of doing these long passages like we've been doing most of the week, we're going to go deep, so to speak, today. So we're going to look at John chapter 14. First, I just want to read it and let you soak it in a little bit. And then we'll talk a little bit about historical context and what might be going on here, and then we'll go into detail a little more on some of the on some of what is happening. So, actually, we're going to start backing a little bit in chapter 13, verse 31, and we're going to go 13:31 through 14:14. That's kind of our context today. So, would someone like to read? Read a section, and then someone else can pick up, and we'll just read the whole thing through once this morning before we go any further.
When he had left, Jesus said, "Now the Son of Man is seen for who he is, and God seen for who he is in him. The moment God is seen in him, God's glory will be on display. In glorifying him, he himself is glorified. Glory all around. Children, I am with you for only a short time longer. You are going to look high and low for me. But just as I told the Jews, I'm telling you, where I go, you are not able to come. Let me give you a new command, love one another. In the same way I loved you, you love one another. This is how everyone will recognize that you are my disciples, when they see the love you have for each other." Simon Peter asked, "Master, just where are you going?" And Jesus answered, "You can't now follow me where I'm going. You will follow me later." "Master," said Peter, "why can't I follow you? I'll lay down my life for you." "Really? You lay down your life for me? The truth is, before the rooster crows, you'll deny me three times."
I think I was a little lost. Were we starting at the beginning of 14?
Oh, we were starting at 13:31.
Oh, okay.
What, can I just ask what translation you have there? Is that
The Message?
The Message, yeah. Yeah, that's what I thought. So someone want to pick up at, we'll do 14, 1 through 14, and then we'll...
"Do not let your hearts be troubled. Believe in God. Believe also in me. In my Father's house there are many dwelling places. If it were not so, would I have told you that I go and prepare a place for you? And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and will take you to myself, so that where I am, there you may be also. And you know the way to the place where I am going." Thomas said to him, "Lord, we do not know where you are going. How can we know the way?" Jesus said to him, "I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. If you know me, you will know my Father also. From now on, you do know him and have seen him." Philip said to him, "Lord, show us the Father and we will be satisfied." Jesus said to him, "Have I been with you all this time, Philip, and you still do not know me? Whoever has seen me has seen the Father. How can you say, 'Show us the Father'? Do you not believe that I am in the Father and the Father is in me? The words that I say to you, I do not speak on my own, but the Father who dwells in me does his works." Believe me that I am in the Father, and the Father is in me. But if you do not, then believe me because of the works themselves. Very truly I tell you, the one who believes in me will also do the works that I do, and in fact will do greater works than these, because I am going to the Father. I will do whatever you ask in my name, so that the Father may be glorified in the Son. If in my name you ask me for anything, I will do it.
What kind of language is this? We're so used to hearing this and, you know, thinking, oh, this is Gospel of John, this is Scripture, but what... How does it strike you?
I think it's very, very intimate.
Because, well, it's theoretically, it should be insider language among Jesus and his followers, who have been with him for a while here. Mm-hmm. Should have been able to figure out how to listen to him by now. But, you know, I don't get the sense that they're getting it.
Right. Yeah, they're still missing the point at times. We don't know the way.
But he's being very intimate with them.
He is being very intimate with them. Sure. Anybody here not a native speaker of English? Or have a non-English Bible with you? I mean, the thing that strikes me about it, the you here is plural. I mean, Jesus is talking to this group, right? The you. But if we were, if it were going to be in a European language for the most part, we would see a difference in this you. Not only would we know that it's plural, not singular, which is easy to miss in English, you know, because we usually... we read this, and sometimes in our individualistic American way, you know, we hear you and we think, oh, it's about me, but it's a plural. He's speaking to his disciples. And in a European language, it would probably be the plural familiar you, right? Yeah. Not
du.
Du, or ihr, actually, in German. Ihr and euch, or I've forgotten my French now, but most, you know, other European languages, they have this, there's a familiar version of you, which is very different from your public, you know, you use the familiar with family, with children. Jesus says he's calling the disciples children here, and with those that you are very familiar with, that you are intimate with. And the other you is reserved for more public context or for use with authority figures. I mean, it strikes me here that this would definitely be the plural intimate that he's using. He calls them children. Anything else strike you about the kind of conversation that's going on here?
One thing that strikes me is that he... recognizing and accepting the fact that there are different levels of understanding. He says that, believe in me that I am in the Father, Father's in me, but if you don't, then believe in me because of the work. So he said, okay, some of you, and some of you.
So he started saying, well, if it hasn't happened because of something else, then at least pay attention to how it works.
Yeah. So he's accepting differences.
This might be kind of the surface level, but whenever I read this, it always seems like exclusive language because it's used by fundamental people to say, we're in and you're not. And this is the way.
When he says, others will know you by the way, you know, you act.
I mean, we do often hear verses from this excerpted, right, just by themselves. No one comes to the Father except through me. As David read that as my title this morning, I thought, oh, this is going to be interesting. Some people are probably not going to come just because of that verse. you know, because we hear that verse taken all by itself as, okay, this is a theological statement, right? As opposed to, this is part of this conversation, this very intimate conversation Jesus is having. Context of this whole passage is what? What's happening? I mean, sometimes in John, you know, Jesus just talks and talks and talks and talks, and we forget that there is actually a context. You know, this is part of a conversation. It's not just, you know, a theological treatise, but in fact there is sort of a context. What has happened at the beginning of chapter 13?
The Passover meal.
Yeah, this is the Last Supper. Jesus has washed his disciples' feet. We've already gotten to the last days of Jesus and his disciples, and he has washed their feet. I mean, this is a very intimate setting, and this is what in biblical circles this is referred to as the farewell discourse.
Yeah.
This is the goodbye scene. So it's not only, I've been with you a long time, it's I've been with you a long time and soon I won't be with you. Very intimate setting for these kinds of words to be happening. Okay. Let's talk for a second about kind of what we know about John as a gospel. John is, out of the four gospels, most likely the one that was written last. Variety of reasons, scholars think that, but most agree that Matthew, Mark, and Luke were written, not all at the same time, but fairly within a period of time close to one another, and John was written a bit later. And because of language, the kind of Greek that it uses, because of theology, because of how explicit and how lengthy it is about who Jesus is, for a lot of reasons they think it's sort of the last one to be written, and written for a very different community. The language is similar in some ways to the epistles of John 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John. And so there's some, again, debate, but some agreement that there is at least, if not one author, at least a similar community that all four of those books came out of, the three letters and the gospel. So this Johannine community that they refer to was its own thing and was probably a bit separate or even estranged from what we call it, the apostolic church, the church that was led primarily out of Jerusalem and Peter, James, and John, and had kind of this sense of being a direct link to the 12 apostles. John does not really use the word apostle very much. He talks about Peter, James, and John and stuff often in negative terms. I mean, the disciples don't get it very often. And they're not referred to as the apostles. I mean, they're not really given that nice honorific title, which leads many scholars to think that this community of John was sort of was sort of in some ways maybe a break-off group, that they had their own sense of leadership, which was not necessarily connected to the rest of the early churches that traced their leadership to Peter and the apostles in Jerusalem. So they had a very different sense of boundaries. They also, because it was the last of the four Gospels to be written, it was the one that was the most, had the most kind of specific and developed response to the events of the fall of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple. John's community had to deal with, all of the early Christians had to deal with this, but John's community had to deal very specifically with the fact that the temple had been destroyed, and not just Christians, but all Jews had to figure out what it meant to be faithful without a place to worship anymore. When the temple was destroyed, it was a huge crisis for Judaism, and Judaism as we know it today is largely the result of that event. Prior to that, you had a variety of different factions, right, that we hear about in the other Gospels, the Sadducees, the Pharisees, scribes, there was a temple leadership, there was, there were very different factions within that, but a variety of different expressions of Judaism. Most of those expressions didn't make it past the first century, because when the temple was destroyed, you no longer needed temple authorities, and really the only thing that remained, the only expression of Judaism that survived, was that of the Pharisees, which most scholars think that's why the Pharisees are often made out to be the bad guys in the Gospels, because they're really the only ones who are left when the Gospels are written. So, you know, I mean, Jesus probably had just as much, if not more, problems with the Sadducees as he did with the Pharisees. But the Pharisees were the ones that were left when the early Christian church was really getting going after the temple was destroyed. So we have kind of a sibling rivalry here. Modern-day Judaism and modern-day Christianity are both the products of that period of time when the temple was destroyed, and everyone had to figure out what does it mean to be faithful to the God of Israel when there's no longer a temple, when we no longer can assume that God is going to redeem God's people by some sort of political center in Jerusalem and a temple and that kind of worship. So the Jews became people of the book, became people who were all about being centered around the word and not around a geographical center, because there was no longer a temple where they could worship. And the Pharisees were the ones who were best set up to respond to that, because they had always been the movement that said this is about knowing the law and being people who live according to the law, and not about particular ritual worship in the temple. So the Pharisees were kind of the only ones who were left. The community of John were Christians who, probably a mix of Jews and Gentiles at this point, but prior to the destruction of the temple, there probably still had been a fairly loose boundary between those who were Jews, who worshipped in synagogues, who worshipped with other Jews, and yet also claimed Christ. And obviously there's some tension there, but there's a lot of evidence that those boundaries were fairly loose early on in the Christian movement, that you had Jews who went to the synagogue, like Paul, you know, went to the synagogue, and they may have claimed Christ, but they were still carrying on their practice of in the way that any Jew would. And then, you know, you also had Gentiles who maybe weren't taking part in that, or were, but were considered sort of converts in the Judaism at the same time that they were followers of Jesus. When the temple is destroyed, there's this crisis of boundaries. There's this crisis of, okay, who are we now? How do we be who we're supposed to be? And one of the things that happened, that there's a fair amount of evidence, that one of the things that happened is that many synagogues began to say to those who followed Jesus, those who claimed Christ as the Messiah, you can't have it both ways. You're either part of the synagogue or you're part of those Christians there, but it doesn't work to do both. And the Johannine community is a community that is responding to being kicked out of the synagogue. A community that's being told, oh, okay, we can't be there anymore. So now we have to decide, you know, we have to be clear about what we believe and who Jesus is. And even though we've been told we cannot any longer be part of the synagogue. And at the same time, within the Johannine community, there were probably Pharisees, there were good Jews who wanted to keep that boundary fluid. And the Johannine community had to say, well, can we allow them to do that or not? The story of Nicodemus in John, you know, is the story of who's the Nicodemus is kind of a good guy, right? But he has to come to Jesus undercover at night. He has to, in order to follow Jesus, he has to sort of be very quiet about how he does so. Many people think that's, for the Gospel of John, that's sort of emblematic of what was going on in the early Christian community. There are people who wanted to kind of go back and forth, but they had to do it quietly because publicly those boundaries were getting more and more rigid. So the internal boundaries of the community are getting more rigid, and the public boundaries are getting more rigid too as a result of this crisis. Which makes me wonder sometimes too, is that, I mean, do we respond that way in the church sometimes? What are the crises that make us say, you know, when things are kind of open and things are going well, we're sometimes pretty comfortable sort of saying, well, you can come in or you can not, but, you know, we don't need to be real clear about who's in and who's out. But where are the places where we try to firm up those boundaries? I think, at least in my context, within the, for the most part, membership, as we call it, is a fairly, we have it, but it's a fairly loose, it's a fairly loose boundary. It's not a real high threshold, you know. It's not like, well, if you're going to join this church, it's like a big step and you got to leave something else behind. There's very little of that. Sometimes when it comes in, when you get to the point of leadership within the congregation, then that boundary gets a little more clear. You know, we want some people to be clear about where they belong. But is there any analogous situation you can think of?
Well, I think it's the expectation that our worship service will provide an inspirational experience. And it may not for a lot of people.
Uh-huh.
It may not speak to them. It may not be their language. So there's a very subtle exclusion there that for sometimes maybe not so subtle.
It's not spoken of.
We're pretty
like
rigid
you're
about this. This is the way we do it. This is what it all means.
Hmm.
And you need to buy into this expression if you want to be a part of the Lutheran Church.
Okay. So that's not, it's a sort of a implied boundary, maybe.
Mm-hmm. We go to the Episcopal Church, and we started an evening song celebration, if you can imagine. And this fellow wanted to say something, wanted to speak. And our pastor, our vicar said, well, you have to be licensed to speak. We're kind of flabbergasted. I said, well, how do you get licensed? I said, well, I get the licenses. Can we? And he said yes, but the church itself is set up so that there can be very rigid controls.
I've often thought it's kind of interesting how within the Lutheran Church, we're very careful about the sacrament, about communion, and you know only few people can be licensed to do that. And you know sometimes we temporarily license a lay person to preside over communion, and then take the license away when they don't need, you know, they're not needed anymore. And I've seen some pretty odd compromises and things made out of necessity with that. But we don't do the same thing actually with preaching, and for the most part in the Lutheran Church, it's sort of assumed that clergy are going to be the ones who proclaim. But in theory, any lay person can preach, and sometimes to me that seems a little bit backwards. Don't you want the people who are really trained to be the ones speaking? And the sacrament seems like something that maybe might be more open to others presiding, but.
Well, I think the call process is the one where there are distinctions made.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not only for the pastor, but also for some of the other folks. If you have a school in connection, our school has not just Lutherans, there are some other folks that are in it, but all, I think, clear confession of Christ as Savior. There's some Baptist folks that are teaching in our school.
Okay. Yeah. So it's with leadership, I mean, at least in Lutheran churches, mainly with leadership that some of these boundary issues become critical.
Even in leadership within the congregation, we're sometimes pretty loose with that, but where it clearly impacts us, and we've seen it in the last few years in our national churches, the ordained ministry in particular.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the biggest line gets from.
Right. Right, and that's partly, again, I mean, that's partly because of our theology of leadership, too. I mean, a lot of people are, the Presbyterian, all mainline denominations have gone through these debates about ordained leadership and sexuality issues and things like that in the last few years. And, my friends in the Presbyterian Church USA, I mean, for them, it's an even bigger issue because their theology of leadership is that elders, and that's, you know, anybody who serves on what we would call a church council is ordained. So when they say they're not going to ordain gay and lesbian folks, that means those folks are excluded from leadership, not just as pastors, as preachers, but as lay church leaders, as council members. I mean, that's a huge deal, you know, even more so. And so they set their boundaries in a different place, so to speak, in terms of leadership, but it's the same sorts of issues.
I think we have some boundaries with regards to administration of the sacrament also. I kind of get the impression that the pastor takes the bread, because if the pastor gives the bread to somebody, then it's okay for the lay assistant to give the wine. And so the pastor's in some way set the boundary. Another issue that's related to that is whether or not the person's been baptized. And if they're baptized, yes, they can have, and if they're not, no, they can't. So we have that particular issue. And then another issue that's somewhat related is I've had folks say, you know, how sincerely do I have to confess every single piece of the Apostles' Creed in order to be a member of your church?
And there are places where that's being challenged, partly for purposes of mission. St. Gregory of Nyssa Church in San Francisco, I don't know if anybody's familiar with it, very Quaker/Orthodox/Episcopal mission-oriented church, very interesting artsy community. And their priests are very explicit that they're just very open about the fact that they will commune unbaptized people, because they see that as an expression of Jesus' table fellowship, which was, his table fellowship was always very open to outsiders. And they don't use the creed in most Sunday morning worship. They're very liturgical, but they don't use the creed. They'll use the creed in catechism and in baptism. And they say that is the place we believe that the creed belongs, is when we talk about baptism. So they will welcome anybody to the table, and then, you know, as especially in that part of the world, you know, they have people who eventually come to faith and want to be baptized. That's when they start using the creed as a means of teaching, and it's in baptism that they first proclaim the creed. And so they've kind of switched around the boundaries on that a little bit. And from my mission experience with Spirit Guards, that makes a lot of sense. And theologically, I think it's defensible in terms of who, the way that Jesus ate with sinners. They want to have the priest says, one of their priests says, you know, I'd love to have inscribed on our, they do have inscribed on their communion table, you know, this man eats with sinners, but they say, what I'd really like it to say is, you know, this man eats with, well, screw up. I won't use the exact quote, but, you know, this man eats with screw ups was sort of his phrase, that's what the table is about. So, but that's drawing on really the synoptic gospels in some ways, and maybe a different sense of boundaries than what John has. Let's read through. I just want to listen again. Chapter 14, 1-7. Just listen to these verses again. Do not let your hearts be troubled. Believe in God. Believe also in me. In my Father's house there are many dwelling places. If it were not so, would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you? And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and will take you to myself, so that where I am, you may be also. And you know the way to the place where I am going. Thomas said to him, Lord, we do not know where you are going. How can we know the way? Jesus said to him, I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. If you know me, you will know my Father also. From now on, you do know him and have seen him. Barbara Brown Taylor has a wonderful sermon on this passage, and she talks about sort of how we've been talking about this being intimate language, that this is Jesus' farewell discourse. He's with his disciples. In this passage, in this particular piece, we don't hear it, but, you know, one of John's favorite words is love, right? love one another, and this sense of intimacy, Jesus and the Father and the Father and Spirit, and then the connection of Jesus and his disciples. I mean, there's just this very intricate web of relationship that is being talked about and wove all through this passage. So she wants to say, you know, when Jesus says, no one comes to the Father except through me, you know, I will come again, take you to myself, that this kind of intimate language, she says it's like when a small child, you know, says to his mother, you're the best mommy in the whole world. Is that a true statement?
Yes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Is it meant to be, you know, a statement of some sort of, you know, parenting quotient, you know, objective hierarchy? Of course not. Same, you know, and the same thing goes with parent to child. My mother-in-law once was commenting. She said, you know, isn't it amazing how, like, every parent, and, you know, you don't really understand this until you are a parent, every parent looks at their child and just thinks they're just the most beautiful thing they've ever seen in their lives. You know, they're just the most beautiful child. And, you know, on some sort of rational level, you understand that this is your particular bias in the world. But at the same time, it's just, you know, why is it that every parent thinks that their child is the most beautiful? Because they are. Because they are. You know, and it's that kind of intimate language, Taylor wants to say, that Jesus is using here. And sometimes when the church has ripped this out of context into making it some sort of objective statement about the preeminence of Christianity over all other religions, that, you know, that Jesus is the only way to the Father, and so everybody else is damned. It's to really do an injustice to the intimacy of the moment. That doesn't mean that it's not true in some ways, but it's a kind of truth that we ought not to confuse with some sort of objective theological doctrine. Right.
So does this language in, let's see, in verse 6, are you kind of implying that it's more intended to be inclusive than exclusive? That it's intended to enfold and to, well, use the word intimate, to be intimate?
To enfold these disciples who clearly still haven't gotten it. Right? To enfold and reassure these disciples who are very close to Jesus in this moment, where he knows he's headed to his death, where they obviously don't understand that he's headed to his death still, right? And he's using, it's almost like he's piling up these words of love and reassurance as sort of a, you know, a stockpile, so to speak, to get them through the days ahead, when everything that they have seen and come to believe about him is going to be tested and shaken. And that love itself may be, you know, in some ways shaken. We this is not what we thought you were about. So, yeah.
The thing that troubles me, though, is that in some respects, the scripture is really an intimate conversation between God and people throughout, from the Old Testament to the New Testament. Mm-hmm. And so in this intimate conversation, then, is where we get our theological treaties, you know, in these, mm-hmm. you know, in our doctrinal statements.
Yeah.
And to exclude an intimate conversation from a doctrinal statement, then, is in some respects to exclude the whole conversation of Scripture.
Or is it maybe not to exclude it from our doctrinal conversation? I guess I'm not suggesting that we leave it out altogether, but to also understand its context, so that it's not every kind of scripture is equally useful in every context, right? I mean, you wouldn't, as the church is still debating, we don't want to necessarily use all the laws of Leviticus in, you know, every context and in every situation as if they were somehow, you know, directly intended for us without some sort of specific historical context, right? And I want to argue that maybe the same thing is true of the Gospel of John. It has a very specific historical context, which you know, in a community that was very beleaguered, that was very feeling very threatened and excluded itself. And their response to that exclusion was to draw in on themselves and to try and sort of figure out, okay, you know, we need to know that Jesus is I am, that Jesus is the God of the universe, that because we've been excluded from the synagogue doesn't mean we're cut off from the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Mm-hmm. You know, all that I am language is a way of sort of reclaiming for themselves the God of the universe. Mm-hmm. And to, you know, reassure themselves of that, that they know, they still know the Father because they know Jesus, even though they've been excluded from the community that they've always believed and has, you know, that for most of their religious practice has been the connection to the great I am, right?
Mm-hmm. I'm just concerned that we become too dismissive of difficult or clear passages like that. I kind of think of Mark Twain's quote about, you know, it's not the passages of the Bible I don't understand that give me trouble, it's the ones that I do understand.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so,
well, that's why I'm doing this one this morning, because it still does trouble me. I'm not trying to sweep away the difficulty of it, mm-hmm. but to say maybe there's a way that we too, you know, what are the ways in which the church may feel excluded from, I mean, I want us to be careful about how we claim language that excludes others, and to be open about the way that we may feel excluded from the world's conversation too, and that sometimes maybe, you know, is our, as a church, is our hanging on to certain kinds of language a way of, is it a reaction or is it a self-conscious, okay, this is, you know, what, I guess I just want to be real careful about how we use that insider-outsider language and the ways in which we know what we're doing when we use insider language that may make it less, that may stiffen those boundaries, make it less more difficult for people to come in. And at the same time, let's be clear that when we use really open, welcoming language, what are we sacrificing in terms of depth, in terms of that intimacy that we believe is part of our relationship with God, too?
It's,
that,
you know, it's interesting in this passage the juxtaposition of that exclusive, seemingly exclusive language. Mm-hmm. No one comes to the Father but by me. And a few verses earlier, in my Father's house are many dwelling places.
Right. And we're going to run out of time. I wanted to look a little bit actually specifically at that verse because many of you probably remember the old translation of it, in my Father's house there are many mansions.
Yes.
You know, and we so often hear this passage as, you know, Jesus talking about heaven, right? You know, the mansions of heaven, and then, you know, of course, then you have all the jokes about, you know, people who think they have to have their own mansion and they don't want anybody else to be there, and so it wouldn't be a mansion if, you know, the other folks down the road were also there. I mean, the word here, dwelling places, is specifically it's sort of a traveler's word. Monane is, a dwelling place is a stop along the way. It's not a, mansion's not really a good translation. As you're traveling, it's a place of hospitality. It's a place where one can stop and have a meal and be welcomed. But it's not a permanent dwelling. And Jesus is talking about going, he's going, and you know the way in which I'm going. This is that's a traveling metaphor. Jesus is traveling towards, specifically towards his death, and saying to his disciples, there are, you know, many stops along the way. There are many places in which you can be nourished along the way, which is a very different kind of, you know, we immediately read this as, this is all about heaven and who's there and who's not. And perhaps for John's community, this is a way of saying there are many places where we can be fed. And the synagogue's not the only one. There are many communities where God feeds us. There are many dwelling places that are also of the Father, that are also of the God of the universe. And so it's a way for them of reassuring themselves that, or knowing that Jesus has said, you know, he will be present there with them as well, not just in the officially sanctioned synagogue from which they've now been excluded. So there are many stops along the way. There are many places of refreshment along the way, not just one place where you have to stop and the only place where you can be welcome. There's not one true community of faith, and if you're not part of that one, then that's it. We've so often read this as a heaven metaphor, and maybe it's not that.
Could we hear what Peterson says?
Yeah, what's his translation?
The rooms part?
Yeah, verse
14.
Yeah. Yeah, verse
2. Don't let this throw you. Trust God. You trust God, don't you? Trust me. There are plenty of rooms for you in my Father's house. If it weren't so, would I have told you that I'm on my way to get a room ready for you?
Oh, I don't like giving up. Don't let your hearts be troubled. That's so much
better.
Using the exclusivity language, it seems to me, I mean, I still read it as an exclusive claim, but it seems to me Jesus saying, exclusively salvation is a free gift. There is no other way than this free gift of God made flesh, freely given for you, for sinners. That's the exclusivity, that there is no human dogma or thing by which we achieve our salvation. It is exclusively through God freely giving himself through humans, through forgiveness of sin.
No way you're going to prepare the room for yourself.
Yeah.
He's going to prepare it for you. Yeah.
Along those lines, too, I would see this as this is God's action. We too much take this, I'm the way and the truth and the life, as actually our action of saying, I understand that Jesus is the way and the truth and the life, therefore I get to the Father. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think, especially the key phrase, I think, in this whole passage is, I and the Father are one. Jesus repeats like about four times in the farewell discourse. And it's that kind of understanding what Jesus is saying, is this is what God's doing here. You know, so what God's done to include the people of the world is to make Jesus the passageway, you know, and where we've, the exclusivity we've taken to that is that, you know, that we have to exactly state and believe that in order for God's action to be real for us.
Right. Mm.
But it's still, it's God's, it's not.
Yeah. And we take the way and the truth and the life to be some sort of creed or destination instead of
folks right, exactly.
The way.
Instead
the person
of, well, yeah,
is
instead,
the way,
well,
not
yeah.
The,
right, exactly. Yeah.
The thing
Thomas
you have to put in your pocket.
Show us the way. Thomas is asking a personal question. Yeah. And, you know,
and Jesus says, I am.
But then Jesus responds to Philip, have I been with you so long and you didn't get it? Who do you see here? You both did God.
Right, yeah. We're almost out of time. Any other thoughts?
The synoptics were written essentially to answer the questions that the Jews were raising. I think John is written considering the questions that the Greeks were raising. So this very much sounds like addressing also the concern around who is God, how many gods, those kinds of questions that the Greeks would have been raising.
Perhaps. I mean, there's also in John a very, you know, very tight relationship to the Old Testament, to Genesis, and also a very, you know, very problematic and difficult relationship with the Jews, and, you know, that whole, again, that's one of the things that makes it difficult is they're trying to understand who are we in relationship to the Jewish
community. Just, I think one of the crises there, and I think it's a crisis in our church, to say the least, is because Lutheran theology of the hiddenness of God, and it's always hidden in Christ, in the cross, and I understand that. But I think he's saying is, how are we going to see him? Seeing is so primary to all the Gospels, but particular John. And I think the context is so important. I work with gang leaders, and their idol is Godfather, meaning the movie. Uh-huh. And conversion often takes place right at this story. that Jesus washes the feet of Judas, and the context here is always betrayal. Somebody is going to betray me. My friends, by the way, my family, not you guys on the outside who don't come in. And I know how powerful that is. Families, talk here. All you get is one family and another betraying each other over something. You know, sexuality, money, doesn't, it goes on and on forever. And I think he's setting it up. Well, who? And then they all look at each other. Is it you? Is it me? And of course the gospel says who it is. But I think the context is so important. And when we do communion now, this is the last 20 years of doing communion. On the night in which he was betrayed, we kind of go by that. And then we forget that in between the bread was a dinner table. And something happened at that dinner table. And I think we need to enforce that. There was more going on here besides what Luther said, you got to remember these two things.
Yeah.
Well, I always remember it. I'll never forget it. But I always stop there in our little group and say, you know, after they sat around and they BS'd about everything under the sun, they came back and took the cup.
Yeah.
Because otherwise we lose the context and it turns into this weird spirituality that Jesus obviously didn't push on us. Well, I think the sin, to me, I would like to actually, young and old, like this young girl here, how are you going to see Jesus? Go ahead, you go want you to have a personal relationship with Jesus. It ain't me, because I look like Sam. You can have a personal relationship with Sam. But I ain't the Jesus that you know in the pictures. So anyway, I'll be in the pictures.
I'll just say a quick word. Tomorrow we're going to go back to Luke, Acts. We're actually going to look at the end of Luke, but sort of in the larger context of somebody. Somebody asked this morning, so what's the, you know, when are we going to get to, how do we know what God is doing in the world, because that's sort of what Acts is about, and how, what does that mean in terms of how we respond, or how we be ready to respond. So that's kind of the question for tomorrow, and we'll get to that, but thanks for those of you here today, and thank you.